Hello, welcome to Base Camp for Men. I'm your host, Tony Rizak. This is a show that gives you insights and resources in how to live a more courageous life. We look to assist you on your hero's journey in any way that we can. Truth is our compass, humanity, our tribe. Welcome and let's get started. Hello, Base Campers. I hope you're all doing well. I have the treat today of interviewing a psychotherapist whose focus is on men and first responders, and he's got a podcast geared towards men and masculinity, and he has different political viewpoints as yours truly, and we didn't scream and yell and call each other names. Gasp. With all seriousness, we cover a wide range of topics today, from the difference between authenticity and vulnerability and why men are attracted to one and flat out run from the other. We also chat about shame and its often central role in the inner lives of men and how to reframe it. And my guest brings up an interesting insight, how politics in this country, because we can't agree on the basic facts since both sides have theirs, boils down to something similar to the Yankees and the Red Sox. It's just about which team you're on as opposed to having a genuine dialogue. All of this is reinforced by social media and the infinite number of AI bots sending out stuff to trigger one side or the other. I think both sides are tired of the division, and I don't know about you, but I miss some of my old friends. Almost everyone I know has experienced a loss of friends and family because viewpoints or values no longer align. This particular healing road is still very much a work in progress for me, and I will continue to share insights and any and all good news that comes my way. Today's interview is a good one. Let's get right to it. Enjoy. Today's episode is brought to you by Stand Up Now Apparel. Stand Up Now has amazing designs centered on God, family, freedom, and patriotism. They use only the softest cotton in their designs and have gear for the whole family. Something for everyone, Base Campers. I know you're going to love their products. Go support them at www.standupnowapparel.com and use the code BASECAMP to receive a 10% discount and free shipping. And now, on to our interview. My guest today is Timothy Winicky. Timothy is a veteran, a psychotherapist and counselor whose practice specializes in helping men, veterans, and first responders gain the skills and knowledge to build connected and purposeful lives. He's also the creator and host of the American Masculinity Podcast. Here is my interview with Timothy Winicky. All right. I am here with Timothy Winicky, veteran and psychotherapist and podcaster Tim Winicky. Timothy, welcome to Base Camp for Men. It is great to have you on your show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tony.
Yeah, you know, before we really get rolling, you know, you and I have a lot in common. We both are zeroed in on men's personal development. We're going to get into all that. We're both podcasters. We'll talk about that a bit. But before we really get started, you know, I saw that you're a veteran and you're focused in on men's work. What, could just give us a brief background, like where you're from, you know, family, how long you served in the military, and kind of what you're doing for work now.
Sure. Well, so I grew up just outside of DC on the Maryland side of things, and then came out to Denver for college, graduated in 05, and kind of fell on my rear end like so many of us did, right? Did everything right. And then the crash in 05 happened, and there wasn't any work for a mediocre GPA with a sociology degree.
Imagine that.
Imagine that. And so I joined the Air Force very late. I went in enlisted because I had a number of friends out of high school that had joined, and they all told me the same thing, that I'd be happier going enlisted into the Air Force picking my job than I would be going as an officer into the Army with the Army picking my job, which I still think is pretty good advice. And then I spent 5 years doing intelligence analyst for the Air Force. And mostly what I learned there is not everything secret is interesting, right? That's a fun thing to know. But I really, the Air Force saved my life, right? I went from being a guy with no job, holes in my shoes, not many prospects, to a place where my kind of service motivation was really given space to move. So I'd been in student government since the third grade. I'd gotten activism awards for different things through college. And so the Air Force was a really wonderful cultural fit for that, for all the different ways you can show up for your fellow airmen. And the thing that got me into human services work is I was stationed in Korea in Osan Air Base. And at the time, Osan Air Base had more sexual assaults per capita than any other base in the world. And so that, with that problem being as big as it was, I volunteered to go be an advocate for survivors of sexual trauma. And then later on, about a year and a half after that, I got tapped to start doing violence prevention trainings for the Air Force. And I got trained by the PhDs that developed out the program. And essentially what violence prevention that we know works is telling women how to be safe in the world is a little silly for an organization to do, mm-hmm. because families and women have been worried and thinking about that since they were four.
Yep.
Right? Yep. So there's a difference between going and getting a self-defense course and some organization saying, hey, carry a rape whistle. So instead, what we focused on was getting people to notice when something could happen and then giving them reliable, reasonable ways to step in to do something. So the joke was, I spent 3 years talking over 3,000 airmen into punching rapists for a living, which is a great job. Highly mm-hmm. recommend it.
Yeah.
Really happy I did it. And then while I was training for that, one of the PhDs that was running the program took me out to that lunch, right? And I think most guys can remember a point in their life where somebody kind of gave them the tap, right? That moment where a professional that did something saw something in you and said, hey, you can do this. Mm-hmm. And that was my moment. She was like, you know, hey, wait, what do you do? Oh, I do intelligence work. And she's like, yeah, you're doing the wrong thing. You should be doing this. Mm-hmm. You should get into human services work. Mm-hmm. And so I got out, joined into a counseling program, continued my work on interpersonal violence. I was generally the first guy to walk into crisis centers and domestic violence shelters to help, and also founded, at the time, the most successful veterans transition program for guys getting out and going into college. Took a program with two people helping about 30 to 60 people a semester to every single veteran starting at the university, getting a mentor and an orientation specifically for the veterans. And then I got to pivot that into my clinical work. And that's when I started working with first responders explicitly. I got really upset. So don't get me wrong, man, we can always do more for everybody. And the veterans certainly still have holes in the systems that support us. But the first responders have nothing nationally. Mm. You know, the veterans, we at least have the VA for all its foibles and problems. We have national organizations, national nonprofits. And 10 years ago, there wasn't anything for first response. If you were a cop or a firefighter, or God forbid, an EMT working for a company, you were treated like the same thing as a janitor would be as far as what you needed and what your support was. Mm-hmm. And so I really built my practice around helping those guys get what they needed and started working with some local nonprofits on how to develop out trainings and the like to help those guys make it through their 30-year career.
Yep.
And it's been fundamental. I still love the job 10 years later. I wouldn't trade it for the world. And since I came in so late, you know, I was in my mid-30s when I finished grad school, I started teaching fairly quickly. And so now I've been an educator within clinical spaces for about 8 years and just presented at the local conference for the state on working with masculinity and masculine issues. And it's been fundamental, man. Like a lot of your episodes talk about guys needing to find their purpose. I think I had about 7 careers before I found this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now that I found it, you know, this is where I get to live.
Yeah. What, you know, how, I mean, I can kind of hear it in your journey, how you ended up picking men and masculinity, and even the first responders is heavily male, mm-hmm. You know, but so was it because, you know, you saw the need in the trauma and the lack of support for the first responders that had you, 'cause you've got the American Masculinity podcast. So you're definitely a voice in the men's work, men's space, men's personal development, men's healing. Was that, something that the bells went off kind of early, or was it like, oh, I really am feeling this pull. There's a need for support in first responders. Oh, look, it happens to be a lot of men that I'm working with.
Bit of a mix, right? Like I always have a lot more respect and care for guys that work in some kind of service. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's just a personal ethics. And as a guy who served in uniform, I'm always going to be drawn to those who serve. The masculinity stuff, though, was I spent 6 years answering the phone and being there for people on the worst day of their life, right? And when you work in a domestic violence shelter and you hold a crisis line, you're going to call at 2 a.m. for somebody who's just lost everything and is bleeding. And after 6 years of doing that, you only see the worst day. You know, as an advocate, you don't really get to see what happens next. You don't get to see the follow-up. And both in the Air Force and in the civilian world, I never saw a single case get justice. There was never a point where the systems worked, where the perpetrators got punished. And that's because that's hard. I want to be really clear here. It's important that our justice system has innocent until proven guilty, but that makes interpersonal violence incredibly hard to try. Right. And so what that left me with was this feeling of kind of emptiness, right? Like I had helped mostly women at that point, a guy here or there, but not many. And I mostly just got tired of trying to clean up the mess instead of solving the problem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so yeah. The reality is that most of the people that hurt people in the world look like you and me.
Yep.
80 some odd percent of all violent crime in America is committed by men. Throughout the world, that number's higher, generally speaking. And it doesn't mean that every man is violent, right? We hear that and we think like, oh, 1 in 5 guys or 4 out of 5 guys is violent. That's not what it is. It's that the ones who are doing it a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so pivoting over to men's work and working explicitly with men has been fundamental because like my favorite thing to do is work with dads, right? You see the generational change, you see the things they're carrying and kind of the misses that were made for them when they were kids. And every generation has misses, right? Like the fundamental truth of humanity is that people care about their kids and they generally do their best, mm-hmm. do the best they can at the time. And so with how fast the world's changed and everything that's been going on, it's been a lot of fun helping fathers figure out how to be a dad in the world and help their sons be good in the world they're joining.
Yeah.
And it's been so healing for me just to see the end of the stories, to get ahead of some of these problems that we have and getting away from that constant, like, you know, night after night of the worst day of someone's life.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, what do you see? What do you see as maybe the two or three issues that men struggle with? It doesn't have to necessarily be a guy that's trying to figure out, I've got these absurd, you know, anger issues where I'm violent, but just like across the board is of the men you work with, like what are the maybe two or three patterns that you go, that always shows up regardless of age, regardless of socioeconomic background or sexual orientation or race? Like these are things that I see men consistently kind of trying to figure out.
Yeah, I think there's a kind of two places that guys tend to come in. It's either the interpersonal, right, where they're not connecting in their relationships or they're not serving their relationships in the way they want to. It's gotten better over the course of years, but when I started, there wasn't a single heterosexual guy that walked into my office that's wife didn't send them. You know what I mean? It was like, oh, I'm going to lose her. Or guys waited till coming to therapy until their life was on fire, right? Hey, sure. She left. Can you help me get her back?
Sure, sure.
And so some of that is helping guys figure out what our fathers didn't have it in them to teach us, mm-hmm. which is how to be emotionally connected as a guy.
Yep.
Right. And we've talked about it like you're supposed to do it like a woman does, right? Like that women talk in feelings and they're very, very egalitarian and interpersonal in how they communicate. And a lot of guys are too, right? I feel like it's important here to mention that whenever I say men are kind of like this and women are kind of like that, I'm talking on a spectrum. There's plenty of women that are very direct. I work with great first responders and veteran gals who speak men just fine.
Sure.
And a lot of my colleagues that are men also speak women just fine, right?
Yep.
But most guys come in and they're just told they're doing it wrong, right? Mm-hmm. Their wives tell them, you know, I want to know how you feel. And then he's never done that before. He doesn't really even have the language.
Yep.
And so the emotional expression is incredibly raw. And for women, that gets scary, right? Because like I said earlier, you and I look like who hurt people in the world. And so when a guy is talking and he gets really elevated and he gets really angry and he doesn't know what to do with it, but now he's showing it and their wife cringes or their wife rolls her eyes or the wife tells them they're not doing it right, it hurts. It's profoundly painful because they took a big risk getting there. And then what ends up happening is before they come into therapy, most guys get stuck in this shame and anger cycle.
Yep.
Where shame is a powerful connector, right? It's in us, it's something we have, and it's something we should have, but we use it poorly as Americans. We use it to contain parts of ourselves instead of heal parts of ourselves. Mm-hmm. What shame needs is you take this part of yourself to your community and you say, hey, I need help either changing this or I need to know that it is accepted here. And instead, what we do as Americans is we go, well, no one's ever going to see that. I'm just going to lump that down into my stomach. But the problem with that is at some point there's boundaries, there's things about you that you've contained so much that you start to get angry, you start to get resentful.
Yeah.
And at some point, if you don't do something with that, that anger is going to come out of you in a way, in a place that's going to hurt people and things you care about. And not like, you know, necessarily punching walls or throwing things, but it's going to be destructive to the relationships and person you want to be.
Yeah.
And so that's one, just getting guys the vocabulary, the help, and normalization for some of that raw masculine emotion.
Before you get to the second one, I wanted to mention something that jumped out at me, because I see two different kinds of men's facilitators, and it always makes me cringe a little when somebody's kind of running a men's group or they're leading and they're like, you know, we teach men to be vulnerable, it's just vulnerable. And I'm like, for me, and this is just, I'm using an I statement, Timothy, I'm just like, my own experience, I'm like, look, men are not interested in being vulnerable. It is a feminine word. It doesn't describe our emotional intelligence. They run from it. If I run a workshop for men saying, I'm going to teach you how to be vulnerable, nobody's going to fucking raise their hand. I don't even want to. If somebody's Tony, you want to be vulnerable? I'm like, no, absolutely not. Did your wife put you up to that workshop? Because it sucks, dude. And I always say, look, I always use authenticity and teach men how to be authentic, because they listen and they go, I want to be off. I want, that sounds like comfortable in my skin. And I will teach all kinds of emotional intelligence work in there. And I'll call it EQ, because men are like, I want to be emotionally intelligent.
Yeah, if we can make it sound like a system or a program, guys.
Totally. Right. And vulnerable. Yeah. We're like, I want to be able to speak in an emotional way to my wife that's authentic. It sounds masculine. When you say vulnerability and feelings, men are just, I roll my eyes and go, I'm not interested, man. And either anybody I know, you know? So anyway,
that's the power of the language, right?
Yeah,
it's hard when we talk about vulnerability, the what people think of is a dude breaking down crying in front of a room of people.
Precisely.
Which is not at all what I ever want for somebody, unless that's what they're choosing to do, unless that's something they want to be.
Yeah.
It's funny. I get annoyed. He's a colleague of mine and he's a friend, and he's been doing the job about 10 years longer than me. So he's 10 years better at it than me, which always pisses me off. I really like how he summed up our job. He's like, I feel like most of our job is convincing guys they don't have to hold it together all the time, but they do most of the time.
Yep.
And so for me, like, it was interesting. I was presenting at the conference this year, and there was another guy presenting on masculinity, and good clinician, solid presentation for other clinicians around the different modalities we use and the different ways to reach men. But he gets to the end of his presentation and he's like, and if we can do this well, we can get guys to take off their armor. And I had a fundamental problem with that.
Yep.
I'm like, there's no man in the world that the minute you say, hey, we just want you to open up and get out of your armor, all that tells him is like, oh, you want me to just bleed in the world. Like, the world isn't safe. The world is going to hurt me, and you want me to just walk through it. And so my frame for it is, I want to teach guys how to figure out when they need the armor and when they can take it off. Right. You don't need to be this bubbling, crying pile in front of everybody in your life. But if you can't cry in front of your wife, maybe there's a problem. If you don't have a buddy that you can tell you're upset, there's probably a problem.
Many men can't even cry by themselves. Yeah. You know, I mean, there's that where they're like, they don't even give themselves permission to kind of break down solo, I think.
Well, that's kind of interesting too, because that was very true for the Xers.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The Xers were the generation of...
That's me.
That's you, right? Me too, man. I'm 79. I'm like right on that cusp. I feel like I feel like the Xer millennial speaker.
Okay.
Xer's whole thing was, you have to be so self-sufficient. A child doesn't need an adult. Here's a toaster, here's a locked door, and here's a TV. Figure it out.
That's it. That's my upbringing.
And that's terrible.
Yeah.
Exactly. There's never been a point in human history where we ever said, you know what, kids don't need adults. But it was the time, right? It was the dual income. It was the first time we were coping with what divorce looks like and how to figure out how to parent.
Yep.
And we replaced so much labor that we forgot that children, yes, there's labor involved, but up until industrialization, there was never a point in human history where one or two people was responsible for everything a child needed. Mm-hmm. And so these were parents doing their best, but it left you guys and me on some level with this idea that we're just supposed to suck it up, take whatever hits we need to, and get to work. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a beauty in being able to do that, right? I think there's an importance and a resilience and a way to impact the world where, yeah, you can put down your pain and push through. That's a valid and wonderful skill to have. But if it's all you do, you're breaking yourself on things that you don't need to be breaking yourself for.
Yeah.
It's one thing to look at something and say, on the other side of that pain is something I want. It's another thing to say, I just walk through pain. That's what I do.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the dark side of X. The other side of X is, you know, we are very street smart and we trust ourselves because we had to trust ourselves young. And we look at millennials and the other generations and go, God, they overthink shit. God, they're cautious. God, you know what I mean? And so there's the other side of that, which is like a lot of the Xers I know are pretty self-realized in terms of action in the world and like, you know, maybe too instinctual, but also very street smart. So there's both sides. And I hear what you're saying about it's not a great way to raise kids if it's like mom's working, single mom, latch key kids running the show with their friends. You know what I mean?
You need more adults around. Like, I don't have kids, but I show up regularly for my friends' little leagues teams mm-hmm. and the birthdays and stuff like that. Kids just need
a
plethora. Yeah. I'm a friend. I'm not even a family member. I want to bring back the idea that your adult friends matter to your kids and that it doesn't need to be family.
We as uncle to include guy friends too, right?
Yeah, I've got my nieces and nephew. I take a little bit more to them, right?
Yeah.
But so that's one thing on this idea of to get close involves being some kind of authentic and some kind of vulnerability with people who have earned the trust for you to be vulnerable around. Right? Brené Brown is probably the person who's written about vulnerability the most. And she is great, but her work is so misused and misinterpreted by the wrong, like what I'm very liberal, okay? Like I think you and I are probably on the political scope very unaligned, but they're the wrong kind of liberal where like we're just all supposed to cry and bring every part of ourselves into every situation and have complete and ultimate safety. That doesn't exist in the world. That's dumb. Mm-hmm. Right. Part of what we have in the world in America that makes it so amazing is that we're the most diverse country in the world. Everybody wants to come here, but we're not a melting pot. We don't become one thing. We're more like a salad and we're delicious for all the different things we can pull from. Right. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean you don't need to be with your tomatoes.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I gotcha. Well, let's bounce over to something you had mentioned earlier, which is a mission.
Yeah. That's the second thing.
Good. Perfect. Let's do that because that's always been a centerpiece of men's work. And then, so why is it so important? Why is it so emphasized and is it still super relevant today as it was, you know, 25,
It's always going to be relevant. The big thing is that with women, there is a event that happens to them biologically that most cultures cue to say that, okay, now you've gone from being a girl to being a woman, and that's menstruation. Mm-hmm. And so most cultures around the world have some kind of thing where women are welcomed into womanhood when that happens. Boys have no such moment. There is no such moment for boys where universally we look at somebody and say, now you're a man. Mm-hmm. Every culture has some kind of test of manhood that you can fail. And that means that you can lose it. So, of course, men are purpose-driven. Mm-hmm. And the problem we have here in America is, like I was talking about earlier with our diversity and all the great things that we have, the one thing that cost us is we don't have a universal, like, okay, now you're a man. The closest thing we have is military service, but I think less than a fourth of 18-year-old boys right now can qualify to get into service.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's not a viable option for most men.
Right.
Right? And it used to be, okay, now you're a father, right? If you're a father, you're a man. Well, now people aren't having kids into their 30s because the economic climate is so crushing that they can't have the money it takes and the resources it takes to have a family. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of guys are just lost without that purpose. And when you, I think you mentioned in the questions that you gave to me earlier is like how the different generations have experienced that. Mm-hmm. At every key point in a man's life, there comes a point where like, okay, so I had my purpose. I had the thing I was pushing and I'm putting it down. And if I don't have something to pick up for the next phase of my life, I'm going to be lost. I'm going to be listless. I'm going to be angry. Like the most dangerous places in the world are where young men have nothing to do.
Yep. Yep. Well, and it's kind of for older guys. I know plenty of men who are in their 40s and they've got a job, but they're not connected to mission. And so they may surf porn a lot. They may video game a lot.
Yeah, maybe they do something to distract.
They do something to distract. You know, the video game becomes the mission. I'm trying to get over a certain level and with a bunch of people, a bunch of other guys, a bunch of other young men that care about this. And that acts as the initiation, which it's really poor. And you had mentioned, you know, military, great initiation, usually will come out with a purpose, you know, like they give you ample opportunity to find how you're going to serve. And then there's things like the Mankind Project, which I did and along with a lot of other men worldwide. And
it's
then
a great program.
It really is. And then things like Sacred Sons. But do you think, like, for me, I don't see how men can find, and then there's, you know, the Christians will just be like, just align with God through prayer and the church. Okay, that's I can see how that could work over there. But do you think, you know, like they used to talk about initiation, you know, in the indigenous tribes, especially like in Africa, the perfect example, the men would come get the boys out of the mother's tents and take them in to be initiated in the jungles. Like it wasn't something that the young boys, and when I say young boys, that could be in our country, 30s, 40s, like it could keep going. If you're not put in a structure where you're going to create mission, I just think the way our culture is with technology and gaming and dopamine from phones, they're not going to try to bring themselves to an initiation that changes them out the other side, unless it's something like the military or the Mankind Project or Sacred Sons, something that's structured for that very purpose. So, and there's just not that many, I mean, there's quite a few people that do the military, but there's not that many people given the numbers that do the Mankind Project or Sacred Sons or whatever else might emerge. You know, you're doing a weekend training with 40 men going through. So it makes a difference, but it feels like what do we have to do to create more structure for this very important initiation that men clearly need on a soul level, and it's sorely lacking, and they don't even know about these things. I mean, yeah, they know about military, but like you said, a lot of them can't even qualify.
Well, I think this is one of those moments where we have to acknowledge that you and my generation failed boys.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't do it because we're bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
We did it because we did what we thought was best for the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
We put our head down, we went to work because that's what our grandfather showed us.
Yep.
And our grandfather showed us a man isn't around a kid. Like you go work, you provide for your family and you take whatever you have to take to do that, but that's your only reason for being here. And don't get me wrong, man, being a provider, it's a powerful role. It's important. I think anybody who's ever been a provider for people knows how sacred that can feel.
Mm.
But we lost something critical. Children need men around.
Yep, they do.
A 8-year-old boy, a 18-year-old boy, a 25-year-old young man needs older men around them, showing them how to be a man.
Yep.
And showing them where they can find some purpose. And we lost that, right? And it's just infuriating, right? Between the Boy Scouts, the Catholic Church, and now like the power structures, right? With all the pedophilia. If you're a guy and you try to show up in these environments, you're immediately looked at like a predator. And don't get me wrong, we need to protect kids. I don't think that's a partisan issue, right? Like
no, it's
we can
it's
all
not.
Agree.
Like, we can all agree. Yeah, yeah. You and I are on the same page with that. Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean protecting them from men.
Right. Well, I just, before you say anything else, you said something there. I remember when my 19-year-old son, when he went through grade school, there was so few male teachers, and they were in fifth and sixth grade, and they had wait lists from the boys' parents in particular, yes. because they were just like they'd been taught by women all the way through fourth grade. And then you're just hoping to get them into Mr. Owen's class because he's such an awesome guy and he just knows boys and he's just, they need that. And they look for that and they gravitate towards him, you know? And it's like, I just remember being kind of sad that there was so few good male teachers in my son's primary school. And it was affirming to me that so many of the boys' parents were like, can I sign something to get him into Mr. Owen? Or I can't remember the other male teacher's name off the top of my head, but there was like a definite, like, a, you know, everybody wanted the boys in with the men. Right. And so I think there's been a failure too in education to not bring good men in to be teachers. I mean, they're paid pretty well where I'm at now in Seattle. There's nothing wrong with the living they're making.
Now.
It used to be terrible.
That's pretty new, yeah.
It used to be terrible. And so I understood why there was no men there. But now I think you could do this full court, like, hey, we need men to help mentor these children. And we need, you know, and...
Well, so but what's interesting is if you talk to the school boards, they've been trying to recruit guys forever.
Yeah.
The problem is that guys tend to be status motivated, right?
Right, yep.
We're not going to go work somewhere that doesn't pay us, and we're not going to go work somewhere that doesn't respect us.
Yep.
And I don't think anybody disagrees that elementary school teachers are not respected or paid.
Right.
And right. So, of course, we lost men. And then you add in all of the scandals and all of the ways that all these things came out about protecting kids, and all of a sudden, if you're a guy and you want to be a second grade teacher,
yeah,
people look at you like you're doing something wrong.
Yep.
And so... And don't get me wrong. Again, we need to protect kids. We need to keep like monsters away. But I also think guys are pretty good at doing that when we're around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, you know?
Yeah.
So right now in elementary school, it's 1 in 10 teachers are male. And in K through 12, it's about 1 in 5. Right. And it's largely because of that status, I think, that status and that social friction. And so where it starts to shift is in middle school and high school when athletics come into play.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, you know, the whole idea of kind of masculine parenting versus feminine parenting. And again, these aren't hard lines where dads don't do the other or moms don't do the other, but right. guys tend to like to teach.
Yeah.
Right. Like for most of my dads, don't get me wrong, man, they something glows in them and they like holding their little bean of a baby, but they really come online when their kid's like 4 and they can show them how to do something.
Yeah.
Right.
I started coaching soccer when the boys were 5 and I coached them all the way till they were 18. So that was I had 18 of them. That was my way of mentoring young boys, you know, and it was great. And it was, you know, and I loved it. And it was, you know, it's a way of being a male presence in there with, you know, a lot of them had really great dads. Some of them didn't have dads around. So it was super gratifying for me to be that kind of twice a week, you know, 3 times a week presence, you know? So, yeah.
Well, and I think some of the dad stuff is getting a little better too. Like the divorce rate hasn't changed, but we're getting better at integrating split households. So what's interesting there is by the data, as long as the father is in the kid's life, there isn't a fundamental shift if he's not in the home.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But if he's shown up to the games, if he gets the kid for, you know, half the time or, you know, whatever weekends he does, but he's active and consistent in that kid's life, all of a sudden the outcomes aren't that different from having a father in the home.
That's right. Yeah, my own father, they divorced when I was 7. Yeah. He got offers for a lot of money in places out of my hometown, but he refused to leave because he wanted to be close to my brother and I. And what a difference that made. I never felt like I didn't have my father. I mean, he also lived really close to us. He made sure his house was close to our house. And so it was like biking over there. So yeah, it was a huge gift. I still thank him to this day. He listens to this podcast. So thanks, Dad, for doing that. It's made all the difference in the world to my brother and I. So yeah.
I love that. Yeah. Well, and he was a rare guy for his generation.
Yep, right? Absolutely.
And again, man, I really want to iterate this. Like, I'm working on a book about generational masculinity in America. And the key thing is not that the fathers of our past didn't care. It's that they did the best with the information they were given.
Yeah.
And your dad's generation was told, whatever it takes for you to provide as much as you can and as well as you can, that's what you do. And everything else doesn't matter.
Yep.
And your father resisted that. And it's just so impressive to me.
Yeah, me too. Me too. It's still the, you know, why are, you know, I've been in men's work. I'm not a psychotherapist. I'm not a therapist like you are, but you gain a certain amount of understanding for shadow work and emotional work when you're in, when you do a training like the Mankind Project, you know, then I led groups for years, decades even. And you know, they all had gifts. There was all these great things about different groups. But I still, my still takeaway, and I'm still part of them now. I get asked to participate in them. I'm in like two or three of them now that you know, I'm part-time on some and more committed on another one. But why are men's groups so good? Like, I just feel like, you know, it's quickly in those groups, this, whoa, this is exactly what I need, is to hear men that I respect that speak the truth about where they're at, whether they're 30, 40, 60, 70, whatever the age is. But I'm just like, you know, I don't have to, I can let my guard down. I can just speak the truth. And just like, it's so heartwarming to hear other men speak authentically about the issues they're facing, whether it's divorce or health issues, or I don't know what the hell to do with myself in retirement, or I don't know what the hell to do with myself as a 30-year-old in my career, and be able to put that in a container that is non-judgmental, understanding, patient, but also where there's a lot of collective wisdom in there, where you can just agree, like, I would love some feedback on this, you know? Do you want feedback? Yes, I would love some feedback from the group on this particular thing, because I feel so stuck and lost and confused. And then hear things in those kinds of rounds where you're like, oh my God, I did not think of that. That is brilliant, you know? And it is... I don't know. I wouldn't be who I am today without men's groups. I owe my life to them. It got me, it changed how I showed up for my wife. It changed how I communicate to other men, how I receive strangers even. I see men as brothers when I first meet them, regardless of where they're at on any kind of spectrum. It has changed things drastically. What do you like them? Do you run them? Do you like to participate in them? What's your take on them? And have you had the gift of being a part of some that were really, really good?
So I had to build one, because like, as my big thing, and this is my stuff, right? Yeah. If I show up to a men's group, I can't take off my clinician hat, which is trash behavior in a men's group.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Right? It is for sure. Yeah.
And so, what I had to do is I had to find some other male clinicians to make a group with.
There you go.
Just cause they're my peers. And when I start putting that hat on, they slap me down, which is great.
Yeah.
But I don't run them. And so I do individual work. I love the deep dive into someone's story, into their psyche, into their world. But I'm not doing my job if I'm not encouraging them to go find community. And men's groups are a powerful way to community. What's interesting to me is the whole men's group movement is really reinventing the wheel. Like, the boomers had the service organizations, right? Yeah. Your Moose Lodges, your VFWs, your
Rotary
Agents, Rotary Club, right?
Yeah, all that, yeah.
And then for whatever reason, they didn't indoctrinate the Xers into it.
Yeah.
And some of it, I think, is because the Xers are like, well, I'm fine by myself because I've always been by myself.
That's true.
Right?
Yeah.
What's interesting to me is if you, like, looking back at the generational track of things, right? You had the greatest generation, then you had the silent generation, then you had the boomers, then you had the Xers. And there's this kind of, like, in and out of community resource and purpose.
Yep.
That goes back and forth based on the lessons of the ones before them, right? We tend to rebel.
Yeah.
But men's groups, I think that they're really good. I think it can be tricky not to find one that's predatory or... basically any of them that you need to show up and pay right away and they're telling you they're going to fix all your problems, there are probably some red flags there.
Sure.
But if they're like, hey, you're going to feel better by being with some guys, that's about right.
You know, I never thought of your insight that the Gen X, that back to that dynamic is why maybe those community groups like Rotary, Elks and all that stuff have floundered. that it kind of fell flat on the Xers out of the boomers' participation. But just also, there's one other piece to that. For me, I've been sober for 13 years. There's a lot of drinking in those places. Like, they just, that's what they do. They serve. You know, they'll put up American flag, you know, whatever is the service, they'll serve. And then what they like to do is they like to drink. They all have like cheap bars where they, and for me, I'm just like, I don't want to be around a bunch of people drinking all the time. Like, it's
and you know, most younger people don't, right?
Like, yeah,
drinking
that's
is on
right.
decline.
Yeah,
well,
it is.
So it was interesting. The VFWs were dying, right? With the Vietnam vets, in part because the Vietnam vets were rejected by their fathers, right? We had World War I, World War II. That's when most of the service connected organizations were founded. Then you had Korea. Mm-hmm. But when we sent our boys to Vietnam, we told them it wasn't a war.
Right.
And when they got back, their fathers didn't let them in.
Nope.
And so they had to fight for presence. They had to fight to be there. Yep. But then they just turned into bars. Like you said, for a long time, a lot of VFWs were like cheap beer and chili, right?
Totally.
Don't get me wrong. There's something beautiful about a place where you can go and sit around with your buddies around a beer. Like, that's a nice time.
You're like, I'm not knocking cheap beer and chili yet.
Right. Like, you know, a beer and a friend go a long way.
Yeah.
But now for me, it's NA beers, right? Like, I still like the brewery.
Totally.
I like the environment, but I'll sit there and not have to have the alcohol as much.
Well, one thing I remember too about a film like all the Vietnam films, but like Born on the 4th of July, is the Vietnam vets, they, when they came back, the fathers were ashamed of them because they had quote unquote lost, right? And so it was not, they didn't carry on in the father's eyes and society's eyes. They were demonized, like, oh, they couldn't win that war. Now, that's being kind of grotesque and kind of broad brushstrokes, but I think Oliver Stone, I thought, displayed it when they came back and Tom Cruise is in the wheelchair in the pool in the bar, and one of the Marines goes, you guys lost the war, how could you? And it kind of illustrated something about they're not being received as heroes. Forget the peaceniks that are like, these are baby killers or whatever. The fathers and the veterans are ashamed of them. Like, that is not an easy place to be in, you know? So,
well, and that's something that I think is tragic, right? When leadership doesn't take accountability for the failures,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not the 19-year-old kid crawling his way through a jungle's job to win the war. It's the people using his labor and his willingness to do something to succeed. And I think that was one of many big betrayals with Vietnam.
Yeah.
Is that the elders failed the guys on the ground by, you know what? Yeah, you tried to do something hard and you failed, but own your failure. Don't put it on a 19-year-old kid who didn't want to be there in the first place.
Exactly. Exactly.
And we keep seeing it, right? Like, what was interesting for me is I think for the Vietnam vets, there was this big, powerful moment when we pulled out of Afghanistan. That was a hard 6 months for anybody who served and had any connection to that. And the Vietnam vets really showed up for the younger guys. They were like, hey, this is our Saigon, man. Here's what this is going to look like. We're here for you. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. this is what that betrayal feels like. This is what's going to happen for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's another thing too, is that masculine culture in America got really ran over by a military culture instead of a service culture, right? So in the 70s, roughly 70% of all CEOs and statesmen were veterans, and a lot of those were combat veterans.
Really? I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
And it's because it's masculine status, right? Like, and so many people served during World War I and World War II. There's a natural instinct in service that you default to the combat veteran in the room. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it should be when you're in service, right? There's 10 of us behind every person with a gun, trying to make sure that they can get home safe and achieve the mission. But we're not them. Like, I'm an intel analyst. I got shot at in high school, not in the military.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so the problem with that is the masculinity required to be effective in combat isn't the masculinity required to be on a playground.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
And because we got so focused on these guys that didn't have a frame for trauma, right? The World War I and World War II was like shell shock, right?
Mm-hmm.
The guys that made it, the guys that were combat veterans that were doing well, looked like John Wayne.
Yeah.
They held it together. They only expressed emotion when it was sexual or angry, because they're the only two things that got through.
Yep.
And they were in control because they had to be. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why the boomers idealized John Wayne so much. This guy who didn't serve, right? Like, I get a lot of pushback from my older guys on this, but I have almost no respect for John Wayne. He didn't serve in a generation where almost everybody did, and then got all the credit for serving because he was the Duke.
Yeah.
But he was a caricature.
He was a Hollywood poster child more than
the real deal. And the superstar of his day, right? I'm not
totally.
Like, trying to diminish his professional career and the entertainment he brought, but like, that caricature of like, that's what a man is what a traumatized combat veteran looks like,
right?
Not what a man is. And that's not to say that the combat veteran isn't a man. It's saying that you don't have to be that to be a man.
Yeah. I had my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, Frank, he served in the Navy in the Pacific, in the World War II Pacific theater. And he was, get this, Timothy, he was, him and I think five other Navy men were ashore when they were ashore for 2 hours. They rotated that when they got the call to go to the Battle of Guadalcanal. His Navy ship was sunk. Like, literally, he's one of five or six survivors of that entire battleship. And he never talked about it. I don't know if he ever talked about it with anybody, really. Like, you know, I talked about it a little bit at the end of his life, you know, as much as I could, trying to get a little bit of family history out of it. But he was of the generation, and he was not, you know, you didn't talk about that stuff. It was too traumatic. He didn't really want to say anything about it.
So it's not just that it's too traumatic, and this is something I think we don't give them enough credit for. Mm. These guys were trying to protect their families. They went away and saw horrors and did horrible things for what they considered to be in service of their country and their families.
Yeah.
They didn't want to bring that back home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to hand that to their kids. They didn't want to hand it to their wives. And so this is where Sebastian Younger's book on Tribe talks a lot about this. It's a short book. It's a great writer. But we're designed for conflict, right? Like, we're apes. And so if our group of apes and another group of apes roll up on each other and there's a conflict around resources, we're going to fight.
Yeah.
And the way that it used to work when we were running around in hunter-gatherers is the whole tribe fought, right? Like, when the tribe went to war, the tribe went to war. The women might grab up the kids and get away. Some of the women might fight. Some of the guys might carry the kids. But everybody was in it together. And when the conflict was over, there were systems and rituals to heal.
Mm-hmm.
And then with modern warfare, we start sending our warriors away. They go away from the village. They go away from the tribe. They go through all these things and they come back completely isolated in their experience. People at best wanting to support them, but not understanding them.
Yeah.
Or at worst, just being so disconnected from the fact that we are in combat. Like, I remember I was in college in the graduate program, and we had bombed yet another country, and I was really upset about it. I was like, oh, great, a whole nother area of operations that we're sending our guys into. And I was talking to a civilian friend about it, and I was upset, and I was talking to him, and he was like, yeah, it's, you know, yeah, so we bombed somewhere else. And I'm like, do you get how many people that's going to impact? Like, one, for the people mm-hmm. we're blowing up, but two, what it takes to get the bombs there,
mm-hmm.
and how that's a whole different place and a whole different area. And all the things that that's going to cost the people trying to do it. We're so disconnected from everything that veterans come home and they can't heal within the community. And I don't know what to do to change that. I certainly don't want to go back to like, we all go or we don't go, right? I don't think that's a reasonable thing.
Right.
But we need to understand that difference so we can start to reintegrate again. Where we can start to have space for the guys coming home to bring in the power, the strength, and the lessons of the military without letting the military be how we think you need to be in peacetime.
Yeah. I remember when, I mean, I was a liberal for 25 years, so I was totally on your side of almost everything for a long, long time. And I remember when it came to war, I remember going, you know, it's hypocritical for Congress or the president to send soldiers, like they should be required to send their own children. You've got to send your, one of your sons has to go serve if you believe in it that much that it's for the country, but you're willing to send everybody else. So I remember going, that seems like a really common sense solution. I bet we would be in less conflicts if that were the case. Now that would, they're never going to say yes to that, but I remember thinking, why don't they send their kids instead of sending them to Stanford? And, you know, and all these things, why not require them, right?
You know,
and I still kind of,
same.
Yeah, you don't think that anymore? Same.
So
yeah.
It was interesting when I found that data around 70% of Congress being veterans, and they still went into Vietnam.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? I think it's more that once you find you have a hammer as a solution, you tend to use
it. Yeah, yeah.
And America, you know, we're badasses, right? That's our story, and it's largely true. We've got the most powerful military in the world.
That's our story, and we're sticking to it, right?
Right, but I think we forget that that's not what we bring to the world.
Right, right.
We've also made it to the moon. We also invented the internet. We also, like...
I know, yeah.
And so it's interesting, too, the liberal versus conservative divide is really unfortunate to me. Mm-hmm. So it used to be that, like, all that liberal and conservative meant was... All a conservative wants is to protect the resources and traditions of what we have that works.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that is like, I think this is where like my grandfather's old adage of, if you're a conservative and you're young, you have no heart. If you're liberal and you're old, you have no mind.
That's right. Yep.
And all it is like liberal is we're looking for better ways to do things and we want to change things for the better. And all conservative is we don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I'd say that's true.
And now all of a sudden, we treat it like a sports team. Like, it's interesting, when they do brain scans about political ideology, it's not about the facts anymore. It's about which side you're on. So it ends up being like the Yankees and the Red Sox in a bar.
Absolutely.
As opposed to just saying, hey, we all like baseball. We started taking sticks to each other.
You know what's funny, Timothy, is I have another podcast that I was hired to do. It's called The American Pulse. I really want to talk to people from all different political orientations to get their, like, honestly, like, liberals will not come on the show. They're like, nope, it's conservative. I could see he's conservative, whatever. And they won't have conversations with me. And I'm like, look, I've even told a couple of liberals that I know. I go, look, I'm not going to ambush you. I'm going to make you look good. I'm going to honor your courage for coming on. And I really want to understand what you feel about this. Like, why do you, for it's just as example, why do you hate Donald Trump so much? Like, just tell us. I'm not going to like start rubbing your nose in all the things that I know that maybe are going to contradict what you're saying. I'm not going to do that. I literally want to know. I'm not going to make you look foolish. None of that. They're like, nope. I'm not doing that. It's like, okay.
What I find is, so one, as a veteran and as a guy with a beard, right? I look like I voted for Trump. I did not.
Of course.
But that means that as a clinician, like, I get conservative guys in therapy.
Oh yeah.
Right. Yep. And most clinicians do not. And really what it boils down to anymore is, it used to be a conversation about what we should do about the things that are happening.
Yeah.
Right. It used to be like, hey, there's potholes. Should we increase taxes or should we cut spending to fill the potholes? Mm-hmm. And that was a liberal conservative argument, right?
Yeah.
Now it's, no one can agree on if there's potholes.
Right. Yeah.
And so essentially, because the information is so divided up, when you can't agree on what is, it's almost impossible to have a conversation about what to do about it.
Precisely.
And so my metric isn't whether somebody's conservative or liberal if we're talking. My metric is, can we believe each other's information enough to have a conversation?
Yep.
And if we can't, then there's not really anywhere to go here.
Yeah.
Right? Like if like the vaccine thing, right? Like, was not done perfect, a lot of things wrong with it, and measles is coming back because people are so freaked out about vaccinations.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
If there are people out there who are like, all vaccinations are bad, I'm never vaccinating my kid because they're going to hurt my kid and there's nothing you can tell me to convince me otherwise, that's not a conversation that we should have, right? We're not going to change each other's mind. Instead, let's talk about like how to get more money in schools, how to feed kids, Mm-hmm. Right? Let's talk about that. There's where there's room to move, maybe. Mm-hmm. But it's so easy because with the online stuff, we're so pulled in to it being this polar thing of it's us against them. And same thing with men and women, right? Like, you've been in men's work now for, sounds like, a few decades.
Yep.
You've been dealing with all the assholes for the last, what, 20 years that have just been yelling that it's women's fault that men are struggling, mm-hmm. which is the least masculine thing I've ever heard of in my life.
Yeah, yeah. I've been spared that. They get called out pretty quickly once safety has been established on that. So
yeah, like, you know, but, it's a societal problem, right? Society has not done what it can for men, but like, we're all here. And if you want something to change, change it.
Let me ask you, because like, it is a big problem of there's facts on both sides of an argument. That both sides are like, look, here's the citations of this study. And then the other side go, look, here's my citations of this study. They're never going to be like, they can't agree on the basic kind of facts. So, and then it becomes a massively, there is no agreement. There is no third study with scientists from both sides. Like, then there's a lot, well, let me finish. And then there's a lot of stirring the pot by bots. Let's just put it that way.
Tons.
Like, so, it's so somebody can say, these mega people are the biggest assholes that have ever walked the planet. These libtards are the stupidest people I've ever seen. That could also be a bot that's like keeps pushing you videos that may or may not be real of a liberal screaming at a freaking something. You know,
or it was the worst day that they've had. Or and that's the thing that made it online.
That's what I'm saying. You know, both sides are being played, and I don't know what the solution is, because you would think like the common sense solution is like, let's talk about it. I don't necessarily agree with what you have to say, but I want your viewpoints are important to me. Let me hear what is important to you, why you're concerned about this, even if I don't agree. But it becomes, there isn't a way other than listening to the other side to say, can we agree on this? Because it's triggering to even say, what about this little piece? No, that's not any kind of truth or evidence, even though it's got citations. And I'm speaking from both sides. It could be the conservatives or the liberals going, no,
we tend to cherry pick research.
Of course.
Right? Because confirmation bias is a very real thing. And everything online is designed to make it happen for you.
Yeah.
So you keep searching.
Yeah, the AI knows what you like, so they keep pushing you.
Yeah, all the places we get our information is monetized to our eyeballs. So they're either going to piss you off or make you feel smug.
Another study that confirms what I already thought. You know, it's like, yeah, that's not an accident that was pushed your way, actually. So,
I think it was kind of like the school shootings argument, right? Mm-hmm. And what to do about it. And what's interesting is we've had a really solid paper answering questions from two smart PhDs. They went around, they interviewed all of the school shooters that they could interview that were still alive. They reviewed all of the school shooters' manifestos and suicide notes. And they spent 8 years studying this. And then they put out a report on what to do about school shootings. And the answer was, it's complicated.
Yeah, it is.
And instead of acknowledging that this is complicated and there's a lot of things we can be doing better and should be doing better, everybody gets stuck on, well, we need more guns in schools. No, we need no guns in schools. We need mental health care for people, as though any one of these things fixes the problem.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I think that's the other thing, is that we're so used to being able to like throw into Google, what's the answer to X? And it comes back with a synopsis, simple answer. And the things that we tend to argue about aren't simple problems.
You're right. I'm so glad you said that, Timothy, because I think on the any of the issues that you and I might differ on, I think the most honest starting point is it's complicated, right? It doesn't matter whether we're talking about vaccines or Iran or Trump or guns or whatever. The answer, it's because it's ambiguous and I know for me, I can only handle so much ambiguity where I'm like, how do I really feel about this? And I think we like black and white, right and wrong. I know.
Well, it's how our mind is built.
Yeah. And it's like, and so it becomes, which team am I on? The Yankees or the Red Sox? It ends up becoming that. It's like, I ride with these guys because I like them better right now or whatever. But the answer is, I think if I was to talk to all my conservative friends and all my old liberal friends from, 5-10 years ago, if we really had an honest discussion about the 10 issues that are driving everybody crazy, I think one of the agreements we'd have is it's a complicated issue. I get what you're saying, right? And nobody ever says
just
that.
Made is the heartbreaking part of that, right? Yeah, the liberal friends that you used to have.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
it is heartbreaking.
And it's everybody can relate to it.
Yep. Or my brother that I used to talk to, that I used to be really close to and I never talked to. I don't have that. But I mean, I hear it from people like, I never talked to my sister because she doesn't like me anymore. So, yeah.
Politics are the new religion.
Yeah. Right?
So people at this point would rather their kids date someone outside of their religion than outside of their politics.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Timothy, let's, I got to get this horse in the barn.
Yeah. If you want me to come on your politics show, we can do that too. But like,
no,
podcast for it.
No, I was going to ask you on the other podcast because I think it'd be great and I think we'd be good together. And it's kind of the dynamic I'm looking for is just to have a conversation. But anyways, I wanted to give you a chance to mention where people can find you. This was a great chat. Where can people find you, your work as a therapist, as a what all the work you're doing to help people heal? And then also, where can people find the American Masculinity podcast? Any other last words before we sign it off today? Yeah.
So I know today that we've been talking from a like liberal conservative paradigm, right? My whole thing is the way that either side does masculinity has been doing it wrong. Mm-hmm. And so I tend to go on liberal podcasts and make arguments on the other end of things. And I tend to be on a conservative podcast arguing for a better kind of masculinity. Mm-hmm. And so if you're tired of the blustery conversations around either gender doesn't exist and it's all a spectrum, or that the only way to be a man is John Wayne, mm-hmm. I'm probably the guy you're looking for. So go to AmericanMasculinity.com. That has all of my work, my writing. If you're in Colorado and you're looking for a counselor to work with, that's where you'll find me. Mm-hmm. And anywhere you look for podcasts, it's just American Masculinity. We have nuanced conversations about these complex topics. We cite everything that we do. There's a fact check at the end of every episode. And we've been doing it long enough now that we're getting some amazing guests on, in addition to just my very strange background of having done interpersonal violence work and men's work. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking for that information, if you're looking for that voice in your life, come find me.
Beautiful. Well, Timothy, thanks so much for coming on Basecamp for Men. So appreciate your insight, your wisdom around all these important topics for men and humanity. Just really appreciate your time today. Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. Go have a listen to Timothy's excellent podcast, The American Masculinity Podcast. He really zeroes in on the inner lives of men and how to find a healing road. I think one of the most impactful things we talked about today is how political issues that divide us, whether it's Trump or guns or climate or country versus globalism, that the most truthful and humble thing that we can each express is simply, it's complicated, to which I can only respond with, maybe the only common ground we can start with in this journey to heal the human tribe is to acknowledge that our differences are a bit complicated, right? Thank you for listening, Base Campers, and we'll see you around the fire next week. If you find value in our show and wish to show us some love, we are now making that very easy to do. You simply go to www.basecampformen.com and click on Donate Support Basecamp. You'll find an easy way to make either monthly donations for as little as $5 a month, or you can donate just once. We love the monthly donation and hope to build this up over the coming months, but any show of support is greatly appreciated, honestly. Thank you for your support and for helping to keep Basecamp as a resource on your hero's journey. That's our show for today. Thank you for listening. Men, good luck in all your endeavors and good luck on your hero's journey. This is Tony Rezac, and you're listening to Basecamp for Men.